This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Literary Studies, a podcast channel for the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Arnab Datta Roy, an assistant professor of world literature and postcolonial theory at Florida Gulf Coast University. Today, I have the great privilege of welcoming Professor Jeffrey D. Leo, who will be speaking to us about his fascinating theory book, Contemporary Literary and Cultural Theory, an Overview, Bloomsbury 2023. Before we begin the interview, I would like to briefly introduce Jeffrey to our audience. Jeffrey R. D. Leo is professor of English and philosophy at the University of Houston, Victoria, USA. He is editor-in-chief of the American Book Review, founding editor of the journal Simploke, an executive director of the Society for Critical Exchange and its Winter Theory Institute. He is the author, editor, or co-editor of 40 books. His recent include Vinyl Theory 2020, Catastrophe and Higher Education, Neoliberalism Theory and the Future of the Humanities 2021, Happiness 2022, Contemporary Literary and Cultural Theory, an Overview, 2023, and Selling the Humanities, 2023. His latest book, Dark Academe, Capitalism Theory and the Debt Drive in Higher Education, will be published later this spring. Welcome to this podcast, Jeffrey. Thank you so much for agreeing to speak with me.
It's my honor, Arnab. I look forward to this conversation.
Okay, so let's get right into it. Let us start with a brief introduction. So can you tell us a little bit about your academic journey? What inspires you to do what you do as a scholar, as an academic, and as an educator?
That's a good question. I'm a first generation college student. My parents did not go to the university. And I think growing up, I was always curious, read a lot, and had a great opportunity to go to a big state university in New Jersey for my undergrad. And I just had these wonderful professors there who challenged me in all different ways to learn different things. And I started out as a music student. I thought I wanted to be a jazz guitar player, and was actually that first music professor. His name's Bill Fielder. He was the teacher of Wynton Marsalis. His class was more about philosophy of music and philosophy in general than most anything else I had ever come across in conjunction with music. And I majored in philosophy and economics, but it was really one professor who saw my interest in literature and philosophy who turned me on to lit theory. I had taken a course with him in Dostoevsky, which was amazing. We read these huge novels. And he said, "Hey, I'm teaching this graduate course in literary theory. Why don't you sign up for it?" And I was an undergrad, and I took the class, and it kind of blew my mind away. His approach was very early. It was just after Terry Eagleton's book had come out. So there weren't a lot of primers on literary theory. He called the book almost like a comic book and had us read full-length Derrida, full-length Heidegger, full-length Roman, Ingarden, and the experience was one where even just to get these books was hard. I had to go to the Princeton bookstore and just buy everything right off the shelf. There were no anthologies or anything, but it kind of inspired me to pursue this nascent field. At that point, it was more philosophy and literature, so I looked for grad programs that had those two strengths. There were not programs, just as today, there are not programs, graduate programs in literary theory. You don't see departments, even though it's a mainstay curricularly. So I found a great university that let me double major in philosophy and comparative literature, and I did a joint PhD, and really just found that it's my passion, this particular area of scholarship, and I founded a journal of lit theory when I was a grad student, and have been going at it ever since.
Awesome. This is so fascinating. And this kind of brings us right to our next question. Can you talk a little bit, introduce your book, Literary and Culture Theory, an overview? What is it about? What is your target audience? What kind of understanding of theory do you want people to take away from this book?
Yeah, I think it goes back to what I was saying about Terry Eagleton. Both then and now, Eagleton really stands as one of the key primers in the field. I speak with a lot of colleagues who still use it in their classes. And I see it as a very particular way to introduce theory to undergrads and graduate students. And I was asked by this publisher, Bloomsbury, if I would write a survey of contemporary literary and cultural theory. And I agreed, but on the condition that it was very comprehensive. In other words, it covered a lot of areas, and that the book wouldn't be as dumbed down as some introductory books. So you don't find a lot of recipes for doing theory in here. I call them, these books like theory cookbooks. Here are the five steps to do your deconstruction, and if you bake the cake this way, this is the result you're going to get. And I wanted to write something that would appeal to introductory students, that told a big story, that had a lot of connections, a lot of points of entry, and then also something for graduate students where, you know, they may know some of these 15 areas of theory, but others they may not, and it allows them to get into it very fast and to get up to speed. in it. So the audiences I imagine are both undergrads and graduate students, that it has both speeds built into it, and with a lot of interconnecting tissue and discussions that go on between these different thinkers in different areas of contemporary theory.
Thank you so much. In your introduction, you discuss something called City of Theory. Can you explain what that is?
I had a challenge that I think a lot of people have who think about how to conceptualize contemporary theory, whether one organizes it historically, whether one organizes it by schools and movements. There's also a toolbox approach, different kinds of concepts. And these different ways of looking at theory tend to get exclusionary. So if you start to follow the historical path or the schools and movements path, it's going to leave out a lot of things. And so I wanted to step back from that a little bit and explain to the reader, look, I realize that there are schools and movements. I understand there some people approach theory as a toolbox. I understand that these challenges are right at the beginning of putting together a story about contemporary literary and cultural theory. So what I'm going to propose to you is imagine me as your tour guide, and imagine us pulling up to this place called Literary and Cultural Theory, Contemporary. Mm-hmm. Stop. And I'm going to show you different areas, different communities, different parts of this city. In fact, I'm going to take you through 15 different neighborhoods, and then each of those neighborhoods are going to have five different parts. In these different parts, you're going to meet different communities of thinkers. They're going to share with you their passions that follow under this idea we call literary and cultural theory. And you have to realize that as a tour guide, I'm going to be a little bit biased. In some of these neighborhoods, I tend to prefer them. I tend to think about them more, but I'm going to try to be as neutral as I can with it. And so it allows a general reader, an undergraduate student, say, to enter literary theory without a lot of pre-baggage. Just imagine you're walking into a community of thinkers, and you're going to learn their agreements, their disagreements, kind of questions they ask, the kind of issues that they're passionate about. And, you know, as we go from different parts of the city, you're going to get to see, you know, differences and similarities among them, questions, disagreements. So I thought that was a good analogy to frame. And indeed, of the 15 chapters, roughly speaking, the first five cover 20th century theory, the second five cover late 20th century theory, so maybe around from 1975 to 2000. Mm-hmm. And then the last five are definitely early 21st century theory, so maybe areas that for the past 25 years or so have been growing. So that's how I came to that. And I don't know of anyone else that's done that, but I thought it might be a nice way to frame the project.
I thought this is a really fascinating way of thinking about theory myself. I mean, I taught this book last semester in my theory class, and students who are undergraduate students who are usually very reluctant when they think about theory for the first time, I think it was a great way for getting them excited about starting on a journey that would take them to so many different ways of thinking about it. So thank you so much. This is wonderful. I do want to ask you about how does this book How is this book different from other theory books that are out there? There are so many out there. So can you talk a little bit about the novelty of your approach to theory? Does this book address any gaps in our current current understanding of or about theory? If so, what are these gaps and how do you address them?
Yeah, that's a great question, Arnav. A couple of things come to mind. First of all, you know, at the outset of the book, I do introduce this city, but I also introduce some different ways of looking at theory. And so, you know, this is another distinction from other textbooks in theory, and I don't know of any that do this. And so I break theory down into 8 different approaches. The first is this idea that theory is just what professors know. It's professional common sense. If you're a literature professor, you have a storehouse of knowledge about theory and criticism, and that's what theory is. The second is the methodology that I was talking about a little earlier. Methodology being there are certain methods that people use to analyze literature and culture, and at their most reductive, they're just recipes for doing theory, you know, for doing criticism, and it can be listed in 2 or 3 or 5 steps. Early in the book, instead of putting a section together on reader response theory, I, in the introduction, just gave the recipe for reader response theory. And so if your readers want to see that recipe, they can find it in the introduction. So methodology. The third being the theory is a set of schools and movements. They go by names like structuralism, Marxism, post-structuralism, and that's what it is. The fourth is probably the most well-known or notorious. The theory is this high theory, that it is Derrida, it's Foucault, it's a very small group of French thinkers who are very, very difficult for most students to read, and it can be very abstract. The fifth idea is this idea of theory being a toolbox. It's a set of concepts, and these concepts can be used to work on or operate on any piece of literature or culture you find. The sixth is this idea that theory is a multidisciplinary endeavor. In other words, every discipline has its theory, and that somehow or other, they're connected or can be connected, that conversations go in and out. And so some of the areas of theory that we know, like semiotics, grew up in linguistics, anthropology, and spread over. Psychoanalysis, of course, was you know, not about literature and its origins. The last two are really kind of my pets. They're stuff that I believe very strongly about, and I think get into maybe why I put the book together this way and how I want the reader to approach theory. The first is this idea that theory is a community or a set of communities. That goes back to that city idea, mm-hmm. that there are different groups, communities that share topoi, places, ideas, questions, zones of interest, and that they talk to each other and among each other about these things and write about them. I really believe that is true. But probably the most unique one in here is that theory is a way of life. It's this way of life that individual thinkers have, and they share with us through their writing. It really if you look at people who do theory, there are a bunch that you really can't place in any school or movement or any set of tools, and the theoretical life then becomes the life that they are. So the distinction of the book then is this welcoming approach to these different conceptions of theory. And I think it's a pretty novel approach. As you go through the first five chapters, they more or less look like your schools or movements. But as you get into the second set of five chapters, they start to look different. They start to maybe look more like the toolbox stuff when you're talking about race and gender and identity and globalization. And then when you get into the last five chapters, there really aren't labels that you can or concepts that you can really put on these. And so it becomes much looser configuration. I think this is my way of engaging the gaps in theory. And so to be very simple about it, the gaps are those things that fall outside of schools and movements, those things that fall outside of high theory, mm-hmm. those things that fall outside of a methodological look at theory. And, you know, to go even a little bit stronger, those things that that fall out of the toolbox, or they have relationships with these different conceptions of theory, but really don't fit into any of them. And I think it allows students to start thinking more broadly about theory, say less Eurocentrically, more in terms of diversity, equity, and inclusion. So when you get into those middle chapters that cover race and justice and LGBTQ plus theory, you're getting into things that are a little bit different than the normal conversations you'll find in an introductory textbook.
Thank you so much. So I do want to dig a little deeper into one of the points that you bring up. So about like, especially about the idea of high theory, right? Students, when getting introduced to theory, are often reluctant because they feel that theory is way too abstract. It's out of touch with reality. So can you talk a little more about how your book and how your approach to theory can find ways of responding to this accusation that theory is too abstract?
Yeah, that's a good question. I a couple things come to mind. The first is, it just goes directly back to my own experience as an undergrad being introduced to theory. It was both extremely abstract and extremely accessible. And so the abstractness was, you know, reading Derrida or Romain Ingarden or Immanuel Kant, a critique of judgment, just raw, straight, very abstract, very philosophical, very dense. And then on the other side of that, having Terry Eagleton just tell you this story, walking you through in beautiful prose by the hand as to what literary theory was. And, you know, I think that this idea of theory being out of touch with reality probably gets at the central point that I wanted my book to address. I want students, I want people who read it to think about those very hard questions about, well, okay, out of touch with reality. Well, what is reality? What is this world we live in? How do you know what it is? What is a fact, and what is judgment, and what is a culture, and what is literature? All those things get into this sort of naive realism, this common sense realism that the untheoretical, the uncritical mind often approaches theory with, and then the response back is stuff that, you know, depending on your reading level, your comfort with abstraction, can be very off-putting, or it can be very, very engaging. And I think I hope my textbook, my book is more, you know, engaging, and gets you very softly into thinking about that question, about abstraction and being in touch with reality. And I hope that the accusation that theory is too abstract is both true and it's not true. I mean, you're not going to deny that some of the stuff that's written is very difficult for the general reader. But, you know, I think that's always the case with writing that's valuable.
Excellent. I do have a follow-up question to this. I mean, clearly, I think what I have found useful about this book is I've found useful in having students think about theory and using that to think about some of the most relevant questions of our time, be it questions of climate change or questions of like our current political situation and whatnot, right? So one of the things that I've seen reading from your other books and this book as well is your interest in intersecting theory with the current stage of higher education. What can be more practical and real than that? Can you maybe briefly talk about this connection? How can theory or different theoretical approaches inform us to think about what's happening in higher education today?
Yeah, I think that the best education puts your world on a table and allows you to take it apart and see how it works. I don't think that should be avoided by a student. In fact, I think that is important. And in that process of opening up your world, your worldview, or go back to this, your way of life, your way of thinking, you start to engage with other ways of seeing the world, other ways of theorizing it, other conceptualizations, other constructions, other points of contact. And, you know, for me, as a philosopher, by training, both undergrad and graduate and with a PhD, it's always been a criticism of philosophy that it's too abstract, it's too disengaged with the world. In fact, the past 100 years, philosophy has really fought with that conception. And to be honest, I don't think it has succeeded in changing people's minds. Philosophers are very self-conscious when they start talking about the current state of affairs. They call it applied philosophy, practical philosophy. On the other side of it, I think theory, particularly critical theory, that comes out of the sociological tradition or theory engaged with culture and cultural studies is very comfortable with that. And I think that is very appealing for students who want to understand their world, the world around them, culture, and, you know, moving outside of their own local spaces into a more global, interconnected. So those middle chapters in this book, the chapter on biopolitics, the chapter on globalization, the eco-criticism stuff where there's climate change, Anthropocene, blue humanities, really open up areas that I don't think enough of this kind of introductory work in or surveys of literary and cultural theory engage. And I'd also say that, you know, for philosophy too, it's just not it's a non-existent kind of area. It's left to the theorists and those people.
So thank you so much. So this book is clearly has been and will be an important resource for anyone interested in lit theory, especially students and educators like myself. So keeping this in mind, what is your recommendation to the audience, to your readers, to the listeners of this podcast about theory? What is so valuable about theory? How must one read theory? What must one prioritize in theory? What pitfalls must one be mindful of when thinking about theory?
Yeah, I go back a little bit to my previous response, and my aim in the theory classroom is not necessarily to share my worldview with students and have them adopt it. I think it goes back to this idea of students come from all different places, all different worldviews. They have different ways of thinking. They have different ways of reading, different ways of writing. And that theory at its best, can help them understand that, how they got to be who they are, how and why they think the way they think, and both the strengths of that and the weaknesses of it. The value of theory has to be understanding literature and culture more deeply, more relevantly. I mean, that's its home. But as you ask those questions about literature, what does it do? What is it? How does it work? And about culture, invariably, it's going to take you into much broader spaces, zones of concern, outside of your own personal worldview, into that of the other, or even if that's possible, and other communities and other parts of the world. The priority for the student, or the priority for the person who's working on this, has to start from what interests you and what you're passionate about. And so, you were asking me earlier about what inspires me, what moves me to do what I do. Well, these are the things that I'm interested in. I've always been interested in them. And I think for students, locating those things that you're really passionate about, that really interest you, and the conversations that open up greater levels of complexity, of depth, of nuance, is important. Theory does that, and when it's doing its best work. And to go back to this abstract, out of touch with reality versus maybe its opposite, completely open, non-dense, in touch with reality, I think it really, it goes back to that reader. I mean, one person's dense prose is another person's lucidity. It depends on who you are and where you're from. My own experience has been that I revel in both worlds. I love the abstraction and the density. I love being in that space that really is not one that I occupy, but seeing the world through that complexity. But I also like making ideas accessible to people, telling stories, and sharing knowledge through stories. And so I think it's for different students that you have to recognize what it is that draws you into this, and stay with that, and don't let go of it.
Wow, this is wonderful, and I especially love that thing that you said: one person's density is another's lucidity. What a beautiful idea! Thank you so much, Jeffrey. This was a fantastic session. Clearly, I have learned a lot about theory from you, from your book, from interacting with you for this interview, and our interactions over the years. And I'm confident that our audience and your readers have learned a lot too, and will learn a lot from this interview. So we are very grateful. Thank you so much again. I really appreciate you coming and giving your valuable time for this.
Well, thank you, Arnab. It's been a delight to speak with you. And, you know, what I admire particularly about you is your passion for your students and for education and to being the best professor you can be. You know, one of the takeaways will be that a life that you changed through your teaching 25 years hence will be on a podcast talking about their professor and how they opened up the world. You know, this future to come, this idea of the world to come, Derrida's idea of the world is always this always arriving future. I think you give it to students through your passion for this area. So thank you. And thank you for the interview and your kindness.
I am so excited about sharing this with my students, to be honest. So thank you so much.